Hello and welcome to the Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast in the Inner Sanctum. Thanks as always for joining me and for being a member of the Inner Sanctum. We're going to be continuing today with our discussion of Shakespeare's comedy, Twelfth Night. We began last week. We look at the background and the context for the play, when it was written, what was happening in Shakespeare's world and his times at the time. The Essex Rebellion, for instance, was a backdrop to the play. Hamlet was written around the same sort of time, so it's rather a contrast between the darkness of Hamlet and this comedy, which is for the most part, except for the malevolent presence of Malvolio, is very light-hearted, whimsical, and one might even be tempted to say it, certainly by Shakespeare's standards, shallow. But Malvolio, we discussed his name, of course, meaning ill will or wicked will or evil will or what have you. It's a thinly veiled Puritan. In fact, he's actually called a Puritan in the play, which is very unusual. So he's the villain of the piece in the eyes of Shakespeare and the eyes of Shakespeare's audience. And we talked about the similarity in the depiction of Malvolio as a Puritan the characterization and compared that with Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. We looked a bit more at Malvolio's character and his importance. He really is the probably the most important figure in the comedy. But today I want to move on to looking at the characters and the plot. And so they're pairings, if you like, between various characters. And so, first of all, Olivia and the Duke Orsino. So Olivia is a countess and Orsino is a count or a duke. And we can imagine that in the city of Illyria, where the play is set, that they are the two aristocratic characters, the two primary members of the aristocracy. And or the Duke Orsino would like very much to woo the Countess Olivia and make her his wife, but she's not in the least bit interested. So that's part of the plot. And then we have another pairing, a pair of twins. They seem to look very much alike, but biologically cannot be, at least my understanding of biology. I'm not very good at these things. They cannot be identical twins because they're male and female, but they are twins and they look very alike. And that's the characters of Viola and Sebastian. And then there's a sort of sidekick, Sebastian Antonio, who we probably won't have much time to say too much about. He's sort of involved in a relatively minor and short and brief subplot. But basically, Viola and Sebastian look almost alike. Viola dresses as a man in order to work in the Duke of Orsino's court. He becomes a page to the... She becomes a page to the Duke of Orsino. Viola, in disguise as a boy, is sent as the Duke Orsino's delegate to woo the Lady Olivia. In the process, the Lady Olivia, obviously believing that Viola is a man, falls in love with her, and Viola, meanwhile, is falling in love with the Duke Orsino, so Viola's in an awkward situation. And what happens in the end of the play is that Sebastian arrives on the scene, and Olivia believes that Sebastian is Viola, and Sebastian agrees to marry her, even though he doesn't even know her, but she's very wealthy anyway. The motive, as they were not, I don't think we're not meant to dig too deeply. So that sort of happy ending, if you like, here is that when Olivia realizes that that Sebastian is Viola's brother, she wants to marry Sebastian. Sebastian agrees to that, and Orsino discovers that Viola, not actually a boy at all, but a rather pretty young lady, he wants to marry her. So we have the double marriage at the end, as befits a comedy. And all of these mistaken identities, what have you, all adds to the humour. We have a wonderful character called Sir Toby Belch. And if I'm sure, I think in a previous Homes Where the Hearth Is podcast, we've discussed the character of Sir John Falstaff within the context of the Merry Wives of Windsor, but also, of course, in the Henriad. He appears in the Henry IV Part 1, Henry IV Part 2, and Henry V, and also in the comedy The Merry Wives of Windsor. He is based loosely on Sir John Oldcastle, who was a founder of the Lollards, who were a pre-Protestant movement and much beloved of the Puritans. So Sir John Falstaff is another dig at the Puritans by Shakespeare, much as Malvolio is in this play. But in this play, Sir Toby Belch has Falstaff-esque characteristics in the sense that he's witty and usually drunk and rambunctious and always looking for an excuse to not only party but perhaps to have fun, and often at other people's expense. So we have his witty presence, and really in this he's the anti-Puritan. He's the foil to Malvolio. And we have Sir Toby Belch is coupled with Sir Andrew Aguecheek. You've got to love these names, by the way. Sir Toby Belch and Sir Andrew Aguecheek. Ague, of course, is like sort of a fungus. And if Sir Toby Belch reminds us somewhat of Falstaff, Sir Andrew Aguecheek reminds us of the character of Roderigo in Othello. That had not been written at the time Shakespeare wrote this, but so if you should really say that Roderigo is reminds us of Sir Andrew Aguecheek. But the point is that Roderigo is cheated, if that's the right word, out of all of his money by the wicked Iago in Othello, because Iago promises him that if he keeps basically spending money, that Iago will deliver Desdemona into Roderigo's arms. Well, the same thing here. So Toby Belch is basically fleecing Sir Andrew Aguecheek of all of his money on the pretext that if he continues to spend his money in the way that Sir Toby says, that Sir Toby will deliver the Countess Olivia to Sir Andrew Aguecheek. There's absolutely no chance at all that ever happening. It's just a means by which Sir Toby Belch makes himself wealthy at the expense of the foolish buffoon who, through his own vanity, believes that the lady loves him when there's no prospect of it whatsoever. So not much sympathy for him being fleeced from his money. The same thing with Roderigo, as Shakespeare wrote in one of his sonnets, perhaps my favourite of his sonnets, "The expense of spirit in a waste of shame is lust in action." Shakespeare, if you like, makes buffoons of those who can only think with their loins and not with either their heads or hearts. And then we have the character of Maria, who's a feisty lady, reminds us perhaps of Mistress Quickly from The Merry Wives of Windsor. But the two characters, okay, which would have the most gravitas, perhaps some of the best lines, are the Fool, who, like the Fool in King Lear, is not in the least bit foolish. He's probably the wisest and cleverest of all the characters in the play, which in this particular play is not saying much, as all of the rest of them are pretty shallow. And the Malvolio despises the foolishness of the Fool. Of course, Malvolio, being a Puritan, has no sense of humour. And this in itself becomes a means by which everybody else has great fun at the humanist Malvolio's expense. I will read some exchanges regarding the Fool and Malvolio from the play. So the Fool says, one of the best lines in the play, "Better a witty fool than a foolish wit." And again, this is a very Chestertonian, turning things inside out or upside down, seeing things from the other way round, so we can see them afresh. That the Fool is witty. He's actually smart and wise, whereas most of those who consider themselves wits in the play and indeed in the world are not really witty at all, but merely foolish. and certainly true of characters in this play such as Sir Toby Belch, Sir Andrew Aguecheek, and indeed Malvolio, who takes himself far too seriously and is foolish in consequence. And then carrying on, the fool says, using some Latin, cuculus non facit monarchum, which means a cowl, C-O-W-L, does not make a monk. In other words, you don't judge a book by its cover. Would be another way of putting it. The fact that someone's wearing a habit does not make him holy. And so again, another wise words here. And here's referring basically to appearances. And of course, this is a play about appearances and things not actually being what they appear to be, with mistaken identity and girls dressed as boys and Puritans dressed outrageously because of their being hoodwinked, etc. And then he says, good Madonna, speaking to the Lady Olivia, give me leave to prove you a fool. So what is foolishness? Okay, a recurring theme in Shakespeare. Olivia says, well, sir, for want of other idleness, I'll bide your proof. In other words, I've nothing better to do. Show me how I'm a fool. Good Madonna, why mournst thou? Why do you mourn? So she's basically in mourning clothes. And good fool, for my brother's death. So brother's died recently. I think his soul is in hell, Madonna, says the fool. I know, says Olivia, that his soul is in heaven. And then the fool says, the more fool, Madonna, to mourn for your brother's soul being in heaven. Take away the fool, gentlemen. So again, he's using his wit here. Why are you mourning for your brother if you know he's in heaven? What think you of this fool Malvolio? Immediately says that. Doth he not mend? So what do you think of the fool? And then basically Malvolio is not at all impressed with the fool's wisdom. He has no sense of humour whatsoever. As he continues to talk, he says, I protest. And again, we think about the word Protestants, but it's what they were is pro test. So they were in favor of the test. So that again, another inkling. And then Olivia says, oh, you are sick of self-love, Malvolio, and taste with a distempered appetite. In other words, you take yourself too seriously, Malvolio. You're sick of self-love, of vanity, and you don't taste things as they should be tasted. You don't appreciate the good, the true, the beautiful, or the humorous, because you're a miserable Puritan. And indeed, as I said, that he's actually referred to as a Puritan directly later in the play. I could say more, but we're sort of running out of time here. So the key thing here, of course, is that we have the wise fool, the foolish Puritan, who is so sure that that Olivia loves him that he is completely hoodwinked by the others and dressed in preposterously loud, bright yellow clothes, which of course, as he's been dressed in black in the first part of the play, as a good Puritan should. He looked all the more preposterous, and they tell him he needs to smile, and because he never smiles, the smile on his face is preposterous and forced. So he becomes an absolute buffoon. And so, yeah, again, if there's a serious side to this play, it's that there's much more wisdom in being light-hearted and full of joy than there is in taking yourself too seriously. And perhaps we'll end, perhaps as a motto or a moral of Twelfth Night by William Shakespeare with some words of Chesterton, which are apropos. Chesterton said, the angels can fly because they take themselves lightly, whereas the devil falls by the force of his own gravity. He takes himself too seriously. This, in many ways, is the message and the moral of Twelfth Night, that The Fool can fly because he takes himself lightly, insofar as the other characters do anything at all, get off the ground. It's their flights of fancy which actually give them life. And whereas Malvolio falls by the force of his own gravity, like the devil he is, he takes himself too seriously. And in his vanity, in his pride, he finds his fall. So some timeless, and as in all things that are timeless, therefore timely wisdom from William Shakespeare in the play Twelfth Night. Thanks so much for joining me. I will talk about something else next week in the Homeless of Weather Hearth this podcast. Please do join me then. Thanks so much for joining me now, and thanks for being a member of the Inner Sanctum. Until next week, goodbye and God bless.